Now and Again is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage, Keanu, and more, head on over to cageclub.me. That is cageclub.me. Please play this song on the radio. Please play this song on the radio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to now Volume 21, the birthday edition. Side B. B is for brunch. I just got a refill on this all-you-can-drink Bloody Mary. The waitress just brought over a red velvet pancake for now to celebrate its birthday. There's a lady with a small dog in her bag at the table next to us, and there are approximately 17 fixed gear bikes attached to the lamp outside of this lovely, lovely restaurant. And sitting across from me, my brunch partner, for now and for always, Nico Vasillo. Nico, how are you?
I'm so drunk I already took my pants off.
You can't do that at a restaurant.
That's what they said.
So side A came and it went, and now is still doing the same kind of format it always has. And we're on the back end, which means VH1 pop and quote-unquote rock and maybe a country song or two. So I guess, you know, we kind of have to jump into it.
I'm willing. I'm able. I'm ready. I do think we're going to see some bad songs by some good artists.
Yeah.
We're going to see some bad songs by some bad artists. And we're going to see some good songs by okay artists. So I think I'm ready for this because it's at least enough of a mix that I don't feel like I'm going to just be in for a beating.
Yeah, the nice thing about Now 21 and doing a drunk brunch for it is that I didn't feel the need to be drunk for this one. There's been a couple of nows where it's just like, I better just lose all inhibition so I come up with something to say. But this is a calm casual now, honestly. There's nothing overtly offensive other than Chris Brown's existence on here. I take that back because there's a song at the end where I might go off Queen. But other than that, like, it's been a kind of a fine now, and it will continue to be a kind of a fine now. And kind of fine, I feel like, is is clearing the bar we've set for this fucking compilation at this point.
I feel like part of the problem with trying to grade these nows holistically, like to say, okay, this is what I feel about the series. This is how I feel about these nows. One of the things I feel like is that there's no actual identity to now. The identity of now is whatever it needs to be to make the money to keep the hits coming. That's all they're trying to do. They're trying to pander. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, did they pander successfully? Did they pander in a way that left their audience feeling cold? We're the audience, you know, and we kind of were the goal audience, to be honest with you, and we're still kind of the goal audience. Getting white people to spend money in dumb ways, yeah, that's the goal. Because ultimately, I do kind of find these nows to be a big waste of money. You're always paying for a bunch of songs you don't want. It's impossible that you're not.
Even people who say they listen to everything, like, you're not going to find cover-to-cover gold here, which is why I'm still shocked that Now exists when you can just Spotify playlist the stuff that you like. And even 10 years ago, I mean, this is, I don't know if I mentioned it on the first side, but this is April of 2006. It's like we're at a point where you can burn your own CDs and you can get a lot of tracks for free, and I mean, you could even just pay 99 cents for it on iTunes. Buy the 10 you like, put that on a CD. It's like, I don't understand how these have continued to thrive.
It's boggling to me because one of the things that I'm really glad you said you can burn your own CDs. I could burn CDs in 7th grade. So
you can even put it on iPod.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many ways to not have to listen to shit you don't want to listen to.
I was burning CDs by this point for like 7 years. I had multiple CD burners. I had a CD burner hooked up to my stereo system that could do things like encode records, and I had another one that was in my computer so I could burn files. It was never a matter of, I don't know. To me, one of the things that I've always been baffled by is why people buy compilations. I've never really understood. I liked the compilations I got as a kid from, like, when my mom would renew her Entertainment Weekly subscription, and we'd get pure 90s, and it was still like 1996, and they'd be saying that this was the best songs of the decade. You know, it was just a compilation CD. But
right,
these nows, they kind of push the envelope on, was this a product that even, I don't understand how they existed. I really don't. I feel like there are people for whom this would be a good selection of songs. That is not anybody who considers themselves a music connoisseur. Maybe that's where we're looking at it wrong.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe
absolutely.
We're looking at this too critically as people who obsess over our music, as people who think about what we purchase and we grade the music and we put it in terms of other things and we consider where the artist is coming from. And As those guys, I think these records are pointless to us. But I feel like there's enough people who would want these five... Yeah, but then again, no, I can't do it. I just can't even justify it anymore because 99 cents. Because you can get the four you want for 99 cents. And then burn it.
When Now first started, especially in the UK, because that started in like the mid-80s, like that's kind of understandable because you'd have to listen to the radio to get the song you liked. And even then, after a certain amount of time, it just wasn't there anymore. So you had to buy the things, and Now worked for that. And speaking of which, I just want to shout out our European correspondent at Fourpush, F-O-R-P-U-S-H. He recently tweeted at me and at Now and Again, saying that while digging through his parents' attic, he found what I believe is the first Now on vinyl up there. And he took a picture of it, and there's enough hair on that cover to do an entire episode just on hairstyles. It is incredible, so check out at Chris Podcasts or at Fourpush to see that picture and that throwback. It was kind of fun just looking at that. But yeah, like back then, that it kind of makes sense, but it's just still happening. It's like we can't stop it now. We've started it, and it cannot possibly end. And I think the next Now that comes out, it'll be 2019, will be Now 69. And if you think we are setting a theme for Now 21, just wait until we get to that one, folks.
Again, I know that we have a regular listener, my friend Tori. She's a regular listener. She loves this show. She's actually one of our best marketing people. She talks all about the shows on Cage Club. And one of the things she jokes about is, you know, one of them is super about pop music, and one of them is super about, you know, like, I don't know how to describe my relationship with music. That, you know, you're super into the music from this time. This is where we're starting to get into the pop music, you know, right? And I'm obsessed with talking about everything. So I do sometimes think these episodes are you trying to, like, you know, narrow me back down. But so she's a big fan. She tells everybody about the show. And I know these are actually totally her thing. These hit everything she needs. It's like 10 songs from around the era that she wants, and it's already in a neat little package for her. It makes sure that the artists get their due. It's a great little way for her to stay current with music, and maybe she'll even listen to the other tracks on there, right? I know for her, she loves things like this, and that's why she's super into listening to it, right? But I don't think I could deal with the unnecessary songs I wouldn't like. Like, I actually find soundtracks irritating when I only want four songs. Yeah. Like, my Tori Amos collection, I have a bunch of soundtracks. I have the Mission Impossible 2 soundtrack because it has Carnival. I have the Great Expectations soundtrack because it has Finn and Siren. But then that also kind of fits my Poe collection because it has an exclusive Poe song, Today. But, oh, it's got Life in Mono by Mono. So other than those three songs, I guess... I have no real need for that soundtrack. The fact that I kind of wish I had multiple copies of it annoys me because I wish I could keep it with my Poe stuff and my Tory stuff. I'm not someone who can deal with songs I don't want. If I'm never going to listen to it, I just don't want it there. If there's an album I love and it has 17 songs and I don't like two of them, I'll create a playlist of the album and delete the two songs.
Absolutely. I mentioned this on the year end or the year in review episode, and I've mentioned it before on the show. I'm a big supporter. One of the nice things about digital and MP3 files, you can just change an album. Like, you can just rearrange the order or add songs that are B-sides that should never have been B-sides, and replace songs that should have never made the album. And you can just make something that you want to listen to and you enjoy. And I mentioned that with some clever cutting and rearranging and adding the EP to the album, the Pale Waves album ended up kind of not being a disappointment in my world, but it's a piece of shit album, but you can change it and make it kind of listenable. I'm a big fan of that. Like, I support making music adapt to you. Like, enjoy the things you enjoy in whatever way you want to. I mean, you can't say that it's a great album when you've changed it from top to bottom, but you can still make it enjoyable for you. And I like that digital can do that, and you should do it, frankly.
I feel like that's something we've always kind of had to do as obsessive devourers of music. One of the things is I tend to like artists who have a lot of B-sides and a lot of bonus track versions. Now, I did not know what you explained to me is that bonus track versions exist in Japan because Japanese albums are so much more expensive. So
yeah,
they make sure those things are fucking packed to the gills. I could never have told you that growing up, but I sure did go out of my insane way to collect everything I could. BT Time. I don't think I've brought him up in a number of episodes, so...
Oh, well, it's a drinking episode, so I'll drink to that.
Yeah, man. Get real crunk. right? Because I think we're still in the crunk era. I think we can kind of get away with crunk if My Humps is out.
Yeah, close.
So BT is famous for having different length versions of his tracks because he's first and foremost an EDM artist. He started in an era where it was very common for artists to remix their own songs over and over again. One of my favorite BT albums, Movements in Still Life, there is something like 8 versions of some of those songs, and it's just which version is it on? It's on the limited edition European version, it's on the tour European version, it's on the standard European version, it's on the extended European version, or the American version, or the American 2-disc, or the American DJ copy, the extended only vinyl version, the double extended single. One of those things. And there used to be a file sharing service called Audio Galaxy. And what Audio Galaxy was incredible for was it indexed everything that everybody had in their share folders with that name, but you could literally pick the person you wanted to download from by song length. So I was able to look at every version of BT's Namaste, and I could find all the different length versions using All Music Guide and comparing the lengths, or using CDNow.com or ABCD.com, all these different like record stores online, and I could like piece together the versions of the albums I wanted, and I would sit there and I would take a look, and I would have like every official remix and every official version, and I would always do what I could. Like, honestly, I would still buy the American versions that I was able to buy, but as a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, I couldn't afford every German version of the record, but I would cut together my favorite version. And I would burn it at what, you know, you had an 80-minute limit, and my favorite version of every song was invariably the 12-minute version, so I could fit, like, 6 per CD. Yeah, man, I've been making super cuts of albums and making the hard choice. Oh, you know, if I want to include all the Japanese bonus tracks and the one bonus track from Germany, I have to cut one of the main songs. Well, one of the bonus tracks is a cooler version of another song on the record. I'll cut the original. And you make these records how you want, and I feel like that's something we've never been afraid to do as people who were never afraid to look a little bit deeper than the albums themselves.
Exactly. I mean, it's just a fun experiment even, and I've always loved making mixtapes. I think there's an art to the flow of an album, and we've talked about that before, and how flow can totally just change an album in general. It's just a fun experiment to me to try to fix the broken things sometimes, even just like taking maybe 2 albums from an artist that came out around the same time and both are just okay. Like, you just make one good album out of them, and then you enjoy listening to that. Like, it doesn't mean that both albums are good, it just means that you have found a way to enjoy them more. And I think finding a way to enjoy something is important in this hell world that we live in.
Yeah, there's 2 Tori Amos albums back to back, American Doll Posse and Abnormally Attracted to Sin, and they're both like with this whole era of bonus tracks. Like, we've been discussing that, you know, there used to be the era of bonus tracks, and now the era of bonus tracks is gone. You know, with these super deluxe, super extended albums, and now albums are 11 songs again. And at the time, Tori Amos was churning out like 19 and 20 song records with 7 and 9 and 12 bonus tracks, and she started producing her own records. And that's the one thing I will say. A big change is I think somebody else should be producing her records from another point of view, to be like, you don't need to hit 80 minutes. You don't always need to hit 80 minutes. It does not always need to be 80 minutes. One of her records, they actually had to print it on a special CD because it was 81 minutes. And part of the goal of that was to make it harder to burn. It couldn't be copied. Mm. So
that's interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, Scarlet's Walk is like 81 minutes and 2 seconds or something, so that it can't be copied. And that's just one way they did it. A lot of people take Abnormally Attracted to Sin and American Doll Posse and cut them down to one singular, like, 12-song album. Mm-hmm. But between the two of them, there's, like, 50 songs.
And, I mean, I talked about doing that with Body Talk. I think that's one good album, and maybe, like, a compilation of B-sides. The fun thing about Body Talk and there being so many songs, I feel like, I think maybe you even brought this up, is that everyone who would make an album out of Body Talk would make a different album, and that's really interesting and exciting, and it'd be fun to talk about, like, why you picked it that way.
That is a really... I definitely wasn't me, because that's really cool. I love that. It's like when we talked about how my buddy Kyle from if everybody's been checking out X's for Podcast, Kyle is the guy that's covering Champions with us. Kyle said that Blackheart is one of his favorite songs on Emotion. I think Emotion is perfect beginning to end. I don't even like Blackheart. It's probably my least favorite song in the entirety of Emotion's A through C. It's probably my absolute least favorite. But I don't have any issue with someone loving it. It's not one of those songs where I'm like, no, I don't get it. That's a song where I get it.
Before we go back into the nows, we briefly mentioned like compilations and soundtracks and things like that. The Needle Drop, Anthony Fantano brought this up on a recent Q&A that he was doing, just kind of as a gag, but it's true. Someone messaged him about how the Shrek 2 soundtrack goes way harder than it would ever possibly need to, and he was like, what? And then he looked at it, and it's true. Like, so it's 2004, so we're not too far away from this in now time. We're only 2 years away from it, but listen to this soundtrack, okay? Let's just get the obvious Shrek stuff out of the way. Counting Crows, accidentally in Love. No thanks. Dashboard Confessional, As Lovers Go, because it's 2004. Holding Out for a Hero, remake by Jennifer Saunders. Don't know who that is.
Well, hold on. That's Jennifer Saunders. That's like absolutely fabulous Jennifer Saunders.
Oh, was she like a voice in the movie, maybe?
She may have been, but I would also like to point out that the Imogen Heap cover of that is the theme song to X's for Podcast.
Okay. She was the fairy godmother in Shrek 2. So there you go. Antonio Banderas and Eddie Murphy, I'm assuming in character, covering Live in La Vida Loca.
Oh my god.
But then, Frau, David Bowie and Butterfly Boucher covering Changes, The Eels, Pete Yorn covering The Buzzcocks, Tom Waits, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. What the fuck?
I just need to point out that this is so many of my artists that it, like, makes my head hurt. And I hate Shrek. So, like, I love Shrek 2, though. Shrek 2 is amazing. That kind of sounds like some, like, major audio file was given, like, executive producer control of the Shrek 2 soundtrack as part of a Make-A-Wish program kind of thing. And they were like, what do you want? And he was like, have you guys ever heard of this random Canadian artist, Butterfly Boucher? She released an album called Flutterby. It's really amazing. And then her follow-up album, Scary Fragile, also really amazing, but no one's ever heard of her. Do you think we should reunite a band that was disbanded after one failed record? Oh, actually, no, wait. Oh, no, I know why Frou Frou's on that. Because their cover of Holding Out for a Hero was in Shrek 2.
Yeah, that's the track. There's multiple Holding Out for Heroes on the soundtrack.
Wait, how many covers of it are on there?
Two.
Oh, okay. I thought you said four for a second, and I was like, why?
The only one that's not on here is basically the Bonnie Tyler one.
I love the Frou Frou one because it's the X's for Podcast theme song, so yeah. I love it. It's my faves.
But yeah, Shrek 2, Tom Waits, Nick Cave. That's a thing.
David Bowie.
Back to Now 21. let's jump into it because we've got Kelly Clarkson with Because of You. Take away the fact that this track and video is very Lifetime original movie. You can't take away the fact that Kelly Clarkson fucking goes hard on anything she's given. Like she's like the Nick Cage of the show. I think, like, no matter what she's given, she gives it all of her effort and she puts it all on the table and she doesn't phone it in ever. She's always going hard on her tracks. Good for you. I like Kelly Clarkson because of that. Even though the song I think is really bland.
Okay, yeah, I love Kelly Clarkson, and this is probably my least favorite song on Breakaway. I think Breakaway is like a solid A of an album. I think it is top to bottom for who she was. I think it was the best record she could have ever released. The second album by an American Idol winner, I think that is literally best case scenario.
Yeah.
Far and away. It's a brilliant record top to bottom. Every performance on there, she sings like if she does not get it right, they will not let her sing again.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to talk anything about that record for me because like it was at a really interesting time in my life and it was super impactful on my songwriting. I hate this song. Legit. This song is so overdramatic to me.
Yeah.
This song is Melissa Manchester, Don't Cry Out Loud. This song is so over the fucking top.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes think the lyrics almost border on Jim Steinem levels of storytelling and the songwriting. Where are they trying to conjure "It's all coming back to me now" and "I would do anything for love"?
They might be.
I feel like there's a story here, and I feel like it's really specific, and that's what gets me. I just think it's too much. I think the song is terrible. I think Kelly Clarkson gives an incredible performance in a song that sucks.
Now and again, complaint from this guy, so I'll drink to my own cliche. Unnecessary key change.
Oh no! I mean, I'm gonna back you up on that. I am famous for hating unnecessary key changes. It's why I think "Key Change" by Maya Rudolph is the funniest single bit of musical comedy in the last decade, and that for me is tough because I have made it very clear that I think Andy Samberg is like the second coming and the funniest person in the world. I know, I have terrible taste, but I think Andy Samberg is literally the funniest person on TV, and I think "Key Change" is still the funniest piece of musical theater we've had in a really long time. And I hate this song, man. It's just so dramatic. And you'll notice I make fun of dramatic songs a lot. I called Jessica Simpson's "Where You Are" and "I Want to Love You Forever" over dramatic. I think MacArthur Park is the worst piece of music of all time because it's over dramatic. Just, I kind of make fun of Stan a lot because, come to think of it, it was you. Like, is so bad. And I just hate over, I just hate the drama. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And this song is every, you were saying that certain things, certain elements were the worst elements of Bling Rap on side A. I'm going to bring it really hard. This is the worst elements of faux emotional pop at this era. This is the worst elements of everybody getting to be a singer-songwriter. This was a time where people were churning out singer-songwriter pieces at an unbelievable rate. Everybody had a lot of feelings and a fucking piano for a couple of years, and you just wanted to slap everybody in the fucking mouth until they stopped doing it. And this was at a point where as long as you were upset about something and hit a high note somewhere, the song, and you were already a hit. This song rested on Kelly Clarkson being likable. If Kelly Clarkson wasn't likable, this song is whiny and desperate.
Yeah. Yeah, telenovelas listen to the song and go, whoa, dial it back.
Right? Yes. Yes, this is Lorenzo's Oil. It's just unacceptable.
Next up is Natasha Bedingfield's "Unwritten." Black Eyed Peas wrote songs to be, you know, what's played when you come back from commercial at the NBA championships. This is a song that's designed to sell Herbal Essences shampoo and pink razors. And the thing is, I don't think it's that bad. I think this wasn't, I'm taking it back. I don't think it was written for that. I think it became that over the next couple of years just because of, you know, kind of how the song feels and its mood. I think they just clipped parts of it and they were like, and buy our products, ladies. And I almost feel a little bad for Natasha Bedingfield for that, because I think she does have more behind her music and her voice than that, but that is what she became.
So I really, 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 really love Natasha Bedingfield as a songwriter. If, like, I think she's incredibly clever. I think she is very dexterous. She can do a lot of different things with her music and her voice, and I think that translates really well to somebody who shapes music. I don't always love her music itself, but it's one of those things. I have an incredible respect for the artist, even if their art isn't my thing. This song was written as a gift for her younger sister.
Okay.
So Natasha Bedingfield's brother, Daniel Bedingfield, appeared on the show with "Gotta Get Through This" and "If You're Not the One." Now she's had several singles. It's this, "These Words." I actually loathe "These Words." It's one of my least favorite songs, if you remember the one I'm talking about. I love you. Yeah. I hate that song, right?
Yeah, no, not good.
I love the verse, but the verse could be from any song. This song and "Pocket Full of Sunshine" and Love Like This, she had a number of really smart pop hits, right? So this song was written for her younger sister who was like 18 and didn't know what she wanted to do. And it's got to probably be hard when you've got like two semi-famous older siblings. And she writes this song, and it literally is meant to be begging her sister to never forget to celebrate every single moment in life, because the rest is unwritten. Right now you have this. Everything else is whatever it's going to be, but you have right now, and it's beautiful. You can feel the rain on your skin, and it's no one else can live it for you. And it's like, literally, I actually think it's a tremendous piece of music and art, and I love the meaning of it. And it was created in a time that by definition was saccharine. So the production, great production, but it is very, I think about those purposely faded chorus woes at the very end in the background.
Oh, with the choir?
Yeah. And I feel so much like if you put this song in the hands of, and I can't even think of like, I'm struggling to come up with the right artist, but if you put this song in the hands of a 1994 Whitney Houston, it would still work. If you put this song in the hands of a 1999 Michelle Branch, it would still work. If you put this this song in the hands of a 2014 Ariana Grande, it would still work, because the frame of the song is great. The production is so annoying.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where it's become this commercial song. And,
yeah.
And I do think Natasha Bedingfield probably has more talent than that. And I almost feel bad that every time I listen to the song, I'm like, yeah, my hair would smell nice if it smelled like strawberries. but like, that's it. Like, that's just kind of what the tone of this song is, and it's kind of what it's become. And I can't separate that kind of commercial jingle from what this song is.
You know, and can I actually bring up something real quick about commercial jingles with you for 1 second? It's so random,
sure.
And you can cut it if it's got to be cut, but I thought this was fascinating. So my husband and I spend every minute of every second together, and you know, my Kevo is my everything, and he and I have really interesting taste in music, and we don't always agree, right? But at the gym, because I go to Retro Fitness, Tempted by Squeeze came on, and...
Mm.
We both began singing it instinctively, and we were like, oh, we have this song in common. After being together since 2007, we're still surprising each other with songs we have in common. It's fucking ridiculous. So I comment that for some reason, in the PLJ of my 7-year-old brain, I thought that Squeeze's Tempted sounded a lot like Don Henley's cover of Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat. So
okay.
We're talking about this,
sure.
Right? And we go online and we look it all up, and it turns out that Don Henley did that cover in like 1992 for a greatest hits collection. So then we look up Tempted by Squeeze. That was from 1980. I could have never said that Tempted was from 80, because to me, Tempted has sort of a timeless quality. Does that make any sense?
I don't... I feel like Tempted really does sound like early 80s, late 70s UK pop.
See, to me, it sounds like
80s. I'm not seeing it from the same angle.
It sounds like 85 to me. I don't know. Like, it was much later in my head, and the Don Henley song was much earlier in my head. But anyway, here's the other thing. It never charted in the top 40 in any country.
Interesting.
It's a song that actually wasn't a success for Squeeze, that later was used in several commercials by several different companies, and then Reality Bites was a fan, whoever worked on Reality Bites was a fan, and had them re-recorded in 1994, so there's a re-recording in 1994 that increased its popularity, but Tempted receives more radio airplay now than just about ever.
Oh, wow. It kind of pulled It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, it really did, and we just think that's a great song.
Oh, it is. It's great. I like that this show, and this is why we are good for this show, and we're good for talking about this, is like, we're debating the intricacies of like plus or minus 2 or 3 years of UK pop. when does this specific song sound like it came out? This really sounds like a June 82 kind of a song.
And I'm like, no, it definitely sounds 1985 to me. I didn't just say like 1980s somewhere. I'm like, no, 85.
Nico, can you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Look at this photograph.
Look at this photograph. Every time I do, it makes me laugh. How did our eyes get so red? And what the hell is on Joey's head?
This song sucks.
No, I hate this song. They're a joke already, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, because it's really funny. When I was doing the last episode, and you'll get to it, we were talking about Rockstar by Post Malone, and I found a mashup of Nickelback's Rockstar over that, and I was like, oh, I didn't know they were funny again.
Oh, yes. Oh, love it. I think this song has a competent chorus, which I think is maybe the nicest thing I can say about this song or Nickelback.
I think we actually have to talk about something else, and I don't think that you're being very reasonable. I think if you don't think we need to discuss the lyric and what the hell is on Joey's head, then I don't know who you are.
What the hell is on Joey's head?
Is he being attacked by a bird? Is it like there's a bird? That's when the sturgeon is a sturgeon a bird or a fish?
That's a fish.
Fuck. What's a bird then? Like when the seagull killed Joey. That's when the seagull ate Joey to death.
A bird is a descendant of dinosaurs that flies and has brittle bones.
All right over here, Mr. Paleontologist, Chris Paleontologist over here.
Stay tuned for my Jurassic cast where we go dinosaur by dinosaur through the Jurassic movies.
And we compare them to the toys over on HTML. So,
yeah, exactly. Brontosaurus, I think you mean Apatosaurus, motherfucker.
I would just like to go out of my way to say that I am actually very disheartened that there are no non-binary toys. How hard would it have been to have a non-binary dinosaur?
I don't know what we're doing anymore.
So the plot of this episode is a disaster, because the two of us are inebriated beyond discussion. I was saying that was something we might do over on HTML, where we would compare the dinosaurs to the toys, and that we would, because I was making fun of the fact that people seem to think that social justice warriors are looking, I'm sorry, so in my head there was a much larger thread. People seem to think that social justice warriors are idiots who care about things like the gender of Santa or gingerbread.
But or gingerbread, yes.
It's more that we were on the third movie of the Marvel Cinematic Universe in the third episode, and that's the point at which I realized, wow, it took three movies to get to four named women.
Jesus, which means at least three of those four are just love interests, right?
Three of them were banged, yeah.
There you go.
And then one of them gets banged by somebody from another movie later on.
Hell yeah, love to bang in the Marvel Universe.
Actually, no, that's another thing. While everything stays visibly heterosexual, all the banging except for talking about banging that happened off-screen disappears. There's no banging in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's in the first two movies in Star-Lord, but like, that's it. There's like no banging in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's nuts. Well, we're going to keep looking at that hypothesis because we're only so many movies in. But it's been a lot of fun. It's a great show. Check it out. But yeah, I was making fun of the fact that people think that we would complain about the gender of, or the lack of non-binary dinosaurs.
Sir, if you remember Jurassic Park, you would know that life finds a way and that all of the dinosaurs somehow become female and are able to give birth. I'm sorry.
I want to keep having not seen any of them after the first one.
Oh, that's absolutely correct.
I've seen the first one, and I saw it in a group setting with a bunch of people who had already seen it, so they all kept screaming about it as it was happening right before it would happen. So the entire movie was me watching three people scream at my television for about 2.5 hours.
That's an okay way to see The Room. That's not an okay way to see Jurassic Park.
Oh, I disagree. It was one of my favorite experiences ever. I've never seen adult men freak out about dinosaurs before. But there in my living room were three grown adult men shouting and pointing at the screen, "The raptor's about to come!" And, like, it was something else.
So, have we figured out what the hell is that on Joey's head?
It's a seagull that then ate Joey, and then the song ended, and we moved on to the All American Rejects' "Dirty Little Secret."
I'll keep you my dirty little secret. Don't tell anyone, or you'll be just another regret. My dirty little secret. Who has
One of the best pop punk songs of this time. That's all I really have to say. And I think, honestly, the next few songs will answer as to why this one stands out, because it feels different. It doesn't feel as self-pitying and whiny, which is something that pop punk tends to do a lot. In both lyrics, in the songwriting, and in the performance, it has a confidence that a lot of pop punk does not have. And it stands out from its peers at this time, even if the band sort of as a whole, after this point, doesn't and is not that interesting. Even before this, they weren't that interesting. They have a very small window of this album and some of the singles off of it where they rise above their pop punk contemporaries. And yeah, no, this is I think, a song that still holds up.
So I have an interesting relationship with the All American Rejects. The guy I was seeing around the time they were pretty famous was super into them. So I've actually seen them in concert a few times. I've heard their first two albums beginning to end, along with a number of bonus tracks and some of their independent material. I have no problem with the All American Rejects. I just don't think they're that special. I think they're pretty forgettable.
Really, I think most of the bands in this genre kind of fit into that.
I would agree. Tyson Ritter, their lead singer, he was, for a lot of people found him really attractive. He had these piercing blue eyes. And he now is on the TV show Preacher.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Preacher is one of my favorite comics of all time. The guy who wrote it, Garth Ennis, he is like the problematic comic machine, but when he writes characters better than anybody else in the world, so it's always worth it to strap in and see if this is going to be one where he pushes a mentally disabled, morbidly obese person out of a helicopter to squish other people to death, or if he's going to maybe rise above it. Unfortunately, they do all turn into that, so just always be ready to step away. And the All-American Rejects, I think, I don't think their music is remembered. I don't think in 20 years, you know, it's something that's interesting. I notice how many songs by how many artists remain in kind of classic radio rotation. So sometimes I wonder who's going to be in our classic radio rotation. The fact that Q104.3 decided that Green Day was going to make it into that when American Idiot came out, and When I Come Around started getting played in this sort of like, oh, classic rock, good guys sort of category, which... that's one thing, right?
Yeah.
But on the subject of Tempted, Tempted is a song that was less popular in its time than it is retrospectively. There's a lot of songs that have not been remembered as well, or have been remembered maybe better than they should be. They weren't the hits that we remember them as, but they've had a really strong longevity. I am sure Toxic by Britney Spears has had a better shelf life than it had debut. I think that's a record that has aged really well, and new generations resonate with it and love it and think it's tremendous. There's so many songs by NSYNC that you just don't hear. There's so many songs by the Backstreet Boys that you just don't hear. Mm-hmm. And they were just as big hit singles as any other Backstreet Boys song. Why is that one remembered? Well, something about the song has a quality that allows it to continue. I do not believe the All American Rejects have a single song that has that quality. I believe their singles were Swing Swing. I forget the next single off that album. Dirty Little Secret and Move Along. Mm-hmm. They followed it up with some stuff that just wasn't as popular. They're not a bad band, but they're a band with no strong identity that connects them to anything in pop culture. None of these songs are over-associated with a film in a way that either increases their value or deadens it. So it's not like it was even that they were... So I've come up with a term for it when it's music that I... like. I never want to hear The Fray advertising a movie again. I now refer to those songs as trailer trash.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I don't even think they're good trailer trash. They're forgettable trailer trash. They're CW episode of the week trailer trash,
yeah.
Not, you know, Judd Apatow movie. And that's the difference.
I think I have heard this song come on the radio in the last, like, year. you can get a room full of people around our age at a karaoke night singing the song. This is probably their biggest song, and it is still remembered more than like a Gives You Hell for sure.
Oh, that was the song I forgot. Yeah.
And I do think, I think they stand out, you know, I'm talking more about the context of pop punk in 2006 versus anything with any kind of longevity. Especially in comparison to the next two songs on this, which are also pop punk songs from 2006. And this, like I said, it's not as whiny and self-loathing as those songs are. It's got an identity. It's got a guitar solo, which none of those fucking songs had. There's a confidence to it that I like that makes it stand out. Like it's saying like, hey, let's just keep being each other's side pieces. And that's okay, as long as no one finds out. Whereas every other song in this genre is like, Ariel, why won't you date me? And that doesn't...
I'm actually going to really counter that. I think this song is deeply misogynistic and disgusting.
Interesting.
I'll keep you, my dirty little secret. One night you'll be just another regret, hoping you can keep it. No one has to know. He's literally saying, I'm embarrassed about you, but I'm going to fuck you anyway. This is the most misogynistic pop punk gets. When the lyrics are, all you got to keep is strong, move along, like I know you do. It's literally saying, you know, oh, it doesn't matter. When stuff's hard, just keep going. It literally takes the idea of the struggle out. Their lyrics are so vanilla and so bland. Swing, swing, swing.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to defend that song.
My heart is crushed by a former love. Can you help me find a way to carry on again? Once again, the lyrics are not, I want to connect with you. It would be one thing if he said, we can be each other's dirty little secrets, and one day we'll just be each other's regrets, hoping we can keep it. No, he says you. He makes it clear he's embarrassed about this woman, but he's gonna fuck her.
I don't see it
anyway.
As embarrassed. I read it differently, especially because of the bridge. I really feel like he's cheating on someone, and that's what this is about. Like that doesn't make him a good person. Like, but it's the story that is being told from the, you know, the singer. I don't see it as.
I just think it's as whiny as anything else in the genre. I think it's just as bad as anything. It's more like whiny straight man crap.
I think it has a little bit more. Like I said, confidence, where the rest of the genre is just like pivoting on your foot while looking down and holding your hands behind your back. Like every other song is fucking Milhouse.
Which is crazy, because I know that we feel the exact switch on this next song.
Ah, okay, yeah, I think this song is well written, but I can't understand a single fucking word in it, so it kind of falls apart for me, because I tried and I literally can't understand a thing he's saying.
I've come to a thing, so I don't really want to talk about it too much, but there's something I'm working on.
Oh, yeah, it's Fall Out Boy Dance Dance.
There's a thing I'm working on where I'm writing a significant amount of music, and one of the things that I'm really aware of is I'm working so hard on these goddamn words that I'm putting with this music, and all I can think to myself is, no, I want these words clearly enunciated. I want people to know my lyrics, and I am not in any way changing that I love Fall Out Boy, but I think if I'm going to take so many goddamn pot shots at mumble rap, I got to take humongous pot shots at mumble rock. I know the words, and like, I'll be honest, I can pick most of them out. Like, I could. I do think it's really funny when people misunderstand his lyrics. I, for some reason, have not had as much trouble understanding his lyrics over the years, but I understand that it sounds like fucking nonsense. Like, it literally sounds like nonsense, and one of my favorite things in the world is I'm an evil man. I'm a little man, and I'm also evil, also into cats.
Yeah, of course.
I think they are such a talented band, and I think the music of this song is oh my god, it's so epic. I just think this is such an incredible song. And the lyrics are a weird balance of confrontational and self-loathing in a way that I think highlights your point and a little bit undercuts the misogyny of it, but definitely highlights your original point about them. Why don't you show me the little spark you've been saving for his mattress? I only want sympathy in the form of you crawling into bed with me. There is something troublingly self-loathing about this song. And I think it's painfully dark in a way that should not have been a single that worked. But there was something about Fallout Boy and this weird little lumberjack man who kept yodeling at the microphone. And no one could figure out what the fuck he was yodeling, but it sounded really good because that's his voice, man. It's what set him apart. Patrick Stump, you couldn't understand a word he said, but when he unhinges that jaw and lets out that noise, it's fucking incredible. You always believe his passion. He never sounds bored.
Yeah, in some ways I kind of treat Fall Out Boy the same way I treat like Japanese punk that I listen to a lot, where it's just like the vocals are another instrument. Because, I mean, I don't know what the fuck they're saying. It's really the same with him, because this isn't even a version, like, with Sugar We're Going Down, I just misunderstand everything. This one, I literally don't think it's words. It's just humming and, like, some bird words. And I don't have anything for the vocals in the song. But if you do know the lyrics and you say they're very self-loathing, Pete Wentz has always really been open about his depression. So that does make sense since he was the main songwriter. But at the same time, I feel like his lyrics... It reminds me of the, I don't know if the story is apocryphal, I don't think it is, but in the first Star Wars movie, in Empire Strikes Back, Harrison Ford just apparently famously improvised a lot of his lines, and at some point he turned to George Lucas and was like, George, you can write this shit, but nobody can say it. And I feel like that's what Patrick Stump is like, trying to sing Pete Wentz's lyrics, because most of them like have no cadence, have no rhythm, they're just like these ideas, they're almost like bad high school poetry put to music. So it's probably tough to sing, especially when you're not the songwriter.
To kind of compare them to another band from the same time that they got way too many comparisons to for no reason, Panic at the Disco, just as much luck understanding what the fuck he's saying, right? Yeah. There was something about high performance that seemed to really cancel out the way people felt about not being able to understand your lyrics. It kind of makes me think of something Paula Cole said. She didn't include lyrics in her Grammy-winning album, This Fire, because she wanted people to hear the songs, and whatever you thought the lyrics were, that's the journey they took you on.
I like that.
And, yeah, you know what? Like, it's a little pretentious. Like, sure, probably, but it actually kind of meant a lot to me. And in a weird way, it inspired the fact that I love it. Yeah, I always, you know, I'm super into minimalist packaging. I love, like, putting everything really tiny so it's hard to read. I don't know why, but, like, yeah, you know what? The lyrics can be in there, but they don't have to override everything. Let the art speak to the person. Don't explain everything about the art. The lyrics, as long as they're mostly understandable, right? But here's an example of where I think you really do need to release either a pronunciation guide or an annotation, maybe, something. Because at some point, yeah, it just does get to be a lot of fun making loud Patrick Stump noises.
And I feel that Paula Cole thing, and I think that's really interesting, because I think everyone has had a song. And I'm not talking this in, like, the... excuse me while I kiss this guy, there's a bathroom on the right, kind of like misheard a famous lyric or whatever. I'm talking about, you spend a lot of time thinking a song was about this, and maybe this song has an emotional impact with you, and then you find out that the lyric is actually kind of different. It changes the text of what you thought was an emotional connection, and that kind of sucks. I can think of at least two or three songs where I've had that happen to me, and so I do almost like the idea of keeping the mystery. Letting the songs, taking the songs out of the creator's hands and her just being like, it's yours now. I really like that.
For me, it's actually a song by an artist I love who no one really knows, but she's had just about the most profound impact on me of anybody, someone named Charlotte Martin. And she has a song called Keep Me in Your Pocket. And I misunderstood a lyric. I thought she was saying, and it's going to sound really silly, but I thought she was saying, your bomb threat isn't more than I can handle. Mm-hmm. And it's, your palm sweat is more than I can handle. And it's a totally different lyric.
Yeah.
And both of them have incredible meaning to me.
We've talked a lot about pop punk on this one, more so than usual. But we've got these fucking also-rans. Reliant K, Who I Am, Hates Who I've Been. And I think kind of some of the stuff we're saying about the worst of pop punk is really shown in this song. It's got a lot of the worst parts of pop punk. That pop punk riff, that, like, if you can just listen, just picture a pop punk lead riff, and, like, that's what you're hearing. You're hearing the riff in this song. It's really bad. it's really self-pitying. There's so much. It's every Newfound Glory Yellow Card song you've ever heard before.
I'm going to be honest. I think that all four of the last songs on this record are like really good examples of I don't think the next four songs are great. And this just kind of bums me out because I really like the Gorillaz and I really like gay Eurotrash. So the fact that I don't like half of this bums me out.
I mean, we can just go straight into Dare.
I just want to put, like, I do think Reliant K is... I like that you said also Rans. Mm-hmm. I think that was a really poignant, important distinction. It's not that Reliant K are one of the bands that got forgotten, you know? When you talk about artists... I'm so glad she's finally fucking famous, but I think if you go back and you listen to the first year of this podcast, we sit around going, I just don't know why Janelle Monáe isn't famous. Every other episode. And, you know, it's not that Reliant K are... I'm trying to come up with a... Reliant K aren't the Nick Drake of this piece. Reliant K are forgotten for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're just not good.
Absolutely.
They're very... Oh, right. Them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I barely knew who they were at the time when I was experiencing the genre and enjoying it.
Yeah, I am really bummed out to go to Dare because I kind of can't figure out how the Gorillaz have a song I don't love.
Oh, wow. See, this might be my favorite Gorillaz song.
Forgot it existed again.
I think it's so
I
fun.
Literally forget this.
This is a dance in your bedroom kind of song. I get a lot of maybe the extremely chavvy backup singer is a little oppressive, but for the most part, I think this is a fantastic song. That if this was another artist, would you dislike it as much, or is it the fact that it's Gorillaz doing this song?
That's such a great question. And
like I feel like, yeah, it's not a Gorillaz-esque song, but I think Gorillaz have always been a band that defied genre.
I would like this song by Foster the People.
Okay.
So figure it. I mean, you know, and I really like that you asked me that because it is something shitty that I don't like about myself. I really hate that the origin of art matters to me. I wish it didn't. I wish that was something I could change about the way my brain works, right? Like, it's just who I am. I used to really, really, really love a comic book artist named Howard Chaykin. Mm-hmm. If you look up Howard Chaykin's art, it is fucking, like, you can smell the fucking gunpowder and cum on his art. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so fucking masculine. There's just something about it, right? And I don't mean masculine as a good or bad thing. I just mean there's something really, like, gritty, male, heavy, thick... whip them out and compare them kind of hairy balls about his art. And he is, unfortunately, a couple of, I guess 2 years ago, they ran a really intense piece on his very transphobic history because he had written a transphobic comic very recently and everybody at the company that was publishing it, Image, was like, no, it's not transphobic. This is a one-off in his career. It's just this story. Take a look at the story before you judge. And somebody wrote a piece that documented 8 or 9 examples of transphobia in his art going back 25 years. He's ruined. I just can't find myself enjoying his art anymore. And
right.
That devastates me. I know we've both talked about it, but I'm going to say it one more time. The guy who made me feel okay about having mental illness, Louis C.K.,
yeah,
taken from me. I just can't deal with it anymore. Like, just and like, not like I can't deal with it. Like, nah, he's ruined. It's fine. He's fucking ruined. Kevin Spacey fucking ruined. It's fine. Just, yeah, and by fine, I mean, I have to commit to it. I want to, but, right, so in those ways, I love Kevin Spacey and, you know, Louis C.K. and Howard Chaykin. I love that I can't help but separate, I love that I can't separate the art from the artist. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's times it really bites me in the ass. And I wind up, like, thinking to myself, I should like that. Why can't I just like that? And it's just a mental thing. I really wonder, now that you say, would I like it by someone else? Probably.
Hmm. Okay, well, there you go. Interesting. And I think some of it comes from gorillas. Maybe, I don't know what the word for it is, but I don't really dig how they have, like, this whole, like, meta overarching story about the gorillas that are going from album to album. You can keep that. I don't care. Kind of like, maybe it's not as pretentious and goofy as Coheed and Cambria when they do it, because gorillas are at their core a comic book. I guess this is kind of supposed to be, from what I understand, this is kind of supposed to be showing that the character of Noodles, the young lady bassist, you know, she kind of enjoys her own music outside of what they're making with gorillas or something, from what I was reading. I don't know. But it's apparently why it's different and why it's solely her in the video as opposed to the rest of the gorillas. Not that that really matters, but that's just a thing gorillas do, is they have this whole mythos behind them. And it is part of why that, you know, taking that into something that I do enjoy, gorillas don't necessarily fit into one genre. And I like that they can be all over the place. Like, Plastic Beach doesn't sound like anything off of the first couple of gorillas albums.
Yeah. Agreed. Also, I like that they're in the Powerpuff Girls.
Yes, yes, they are. That is canon now. Is that one of the bad guy or whatever took over for the bassist or something? I don't know. I can't be arsed to figure out a band's arc.
I think it's really interesting, though, because I do love the Gorillaz. This isn't a song I don't love. That's literally it. I'm a big Gorillaz fan. I think they've come up once or twice, and I've talked about how much I love them, and I love the concept, and I love the story. I maybe didn't think this last album was the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah, it's whatever.
I don't want to say I felt it was whatever. I think I played it 3 times. And, you know, it's interesting when you play an album once, and you can still sing the songs from it. A year later or something, like the songs just stuck with you somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the Gorillaz are a band like that whose songs usually do stick with me, which is one of my comment that this one doesn't bothers me. So, I love their arc. I love the story. You know, we were talking about Body Talk before, but Body Talk is this incredible, like, journey that you get to piece together. There's no actual story, but you can kind of pretend there's a story. It's really kind of like a song cycle, maybe. But, like, it's kind of a story. The Gorillaz do give you enough of a story that I buy into it. They put in enough effort. I don't think everybody puts in enough effort when Tori or Nikki, you know, Amos and Minaj, respectively, launch new characters into their universe.
Right.
I'm always kind of like, okay, well, it's basically you.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Okay, whatever. But when the Gorillaz, I really don't think of Gorillaz as, oh, right, the guy from Blur.
Yeah, same. I think that's a fun trivia aspect of Gorillaz, but Damon Albarn has managed to separate himself kind of from the band he created, which is really unique and cool.
Yes. From both bands he's created. I feel like he exists as an entity outside of Blur and outside of the Gorillaz.
And
by virtue of the other one existing.
Right, and I've never listened to his other, what, The Good, the Bad, and the Queen or something like that. I've never dabbled in that project he's done. Dude is always making music, and I can get down with that, good or bad, just like people who grind that shit out and just love to do the thing that they're doing. It's something I'm super
Prince,
into, whether I like
what?
Every part of it or not.
41 records underneath Prince's house or something, you know?
Yeah.
And if you were a member of his fan clubs and you got the other 67,000 records that came out each month, Prince was such a fucking weird person like that. He would be like, join my fan club, get a record every month. What?
Yeah.
Most of the songs are just 45 minutes of him going, oh, over like a funky beat, but like, I'm into it.
Can we just keep stretching this conversation so we don't have to talk about the next song?
I literally didn't think this song was real. I thought this song was like a parody I seriously thought this was like an SNL song parody. I thought this was a joke. I've spent this whole time thinking this was a joke, and I think one time on the show previously you'd mentioned this was a real song,
yeah.
Which was the only reason when I saw it here I didn't think it was a joke. I was like, is it like when they did the sunscreen song and that like kind of shouldn't be on here, always wear sunscreen? Is it like when they did that? Because okay, no, this I'm mad, bro.
Yeah, this is Trace Adkins, Honky Tonk Badonkadonk.
Shut my mouth, slap your grandma. There ought to be a law. Get the sheriff on the phone. Lord have mercy, how she even get them bridges on that honky tonk, the donkey donk.
This song infuriates me. This song makes me angry that I was born with ears. I fucking hate this. Like, flames on the side of my head, loss of words. I'm going to attempt to explain why I find the song so offensive, but like, it's gonna take some time and it's gonna take some editing because I'm just gonna fumble over my own anger a lot. Just FYI. So if this sounds like a weird, a bunch of cuts, like, it sounds like fucking a YouTube blogger style editing, I apologize, but man, I don't think I can talk about the song without getting furious.
I have an opinion. I'm pretty sure you will knock out my opinion in your explanation of why you find this song infuriating. It does come down to the word appropriation.
Yep, mine. Oh God, word for word. I think we're going to go. This I think is the epitome of appropriation.
Yeah, this is, and the reason the appropriation is so aggravating is because I bet if Missy came on saying "badonk donk donk," I am not grouping any group of people. I am not saying all people who like this song would feel any way about the music that this song is drawn from.
Oh, I would.
Or the, you know, I will not say all people. Because no. I know people who like both. I don't know how you live in the dichotomy of a culture that is ensconced heavily in the idea that progressive change is wrong and accepting things is wrong, but okay. You know what? Okay. I don't want to say anything because I don't want to be that guy, and I'm not trying to get political even for one fucking second right now, but this is a really tense couple of weeks we've been living in, mm-hmm. politically speaking, and I've been really reserved, and I've been really good on my other shows, because my other shows, that's not what we talk about in the least, right? But my favorite thing to sum up the last couple of fucking weeks with everything going on with politics in this country is that post that says, "Millennials, stop demanding participation trophies," and the response being, "Okay, it's time to get rid of the Confederate flags."
Right. Yeah. The Confederate statues are like the oldest participation trophies in history.
Yeah. I am. There's such a feeling of we were hoodwinked. No, 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 no. If the sign said, "Don't press the button," and the con man in front of you said, "No, I promise you, it's okay, press the button. I don't work here, but it's time to shake things up. Press the button." And you pressed the button. You were not hoodwinked. You were willfully ignorant. And that is different. So, I feel very angry right now about a lot of things. And one of those things is... Sorry, I just got a little carried away there. One of those things is the general sense of double standard
mm-hmm.
that exists inherently in a song like "Honky Tonk Badonka Donk," exclusively yeah. being performed. Yeah, I don't feel this song represents I don't feel this song represents the badonkadonk side of things in any way. The three men who wrote it, Dallas Davidson, Randy Houser, and Jamie Johnson, as well as the artist who recorded it, Trace Adkins, all four of them are white.
Mm-hmm.
And all four of them are country musicians. That's really all I've got. I just want to stop yelling. And so you should take over.
I think it's important to talk about... the actual kind of view of cultural appropriation and sort of how am I going to say this? Let me finish before, let me get all of this out. Kind of the Twitterati view of cultural appropriation. When Becky from the Sig Delt sorority dresses up like Pocahontas for Halloween, cultural appropriation, but mostly it's just really fucking stupid. Like, you should know better, Becky. It's offensive and it's dumb because of the history behind it and what it's doing, but it's kind of draws the line at just really fucking stupid, because Becky probably wasn't trying to be a piece of shit. She's just dumb. But what Trace Adkins is doing here, and his writers, is literally appropriating an entire genre of music that's based around both race and class and culture that is not his, and actually appropriating it and whitewashing it, literally whitewashing it, what is this Caucasian nonsense, to make money. And that is like aggressive appropriation in a really, really malicious, gross way. This is the thing that you've heard a lot about, that cultural appropriation. Like, this is it. This is the core. This is the worst version of it. And it's the one that you should be the most mad about.
When a famous person from the majority that part of culture does not belong to decides to use it to make money, that is almost invariably white nonsense.
Yeah. And I think you were kind of hinting at this, but you wanted to kind of be like hashtag not all. But I do think this is marketed as essentially a rap song for people who would never, who would say a lot of racist stuff before they listen to any rap music. That's who this is for.
Yes, I don't.
And it's gross.
I hate that I am saying not all, but you know what? Yeah, not all. For real, not all. Not everyone who appreciates country music has an inherent disdain for black culture. That would be the stupidest thing I could say. What a fucking dumb thing. But there is enough of white America that believes that everything should belong to them, and they should get to remove the people from whom that culture is from.
Exactly.
And you cannot have the culture without having the people. If Trace Adkins wanted to record this with a black country artist, I'd probably be a little bit more okay with that. I would think it's pandery. I would think it's a little white savory, but I think I would feel there's at least an attempt to get some. I would probably prefer a hip hop artist, don't get me wrong, but I would at least see it as an attempt.
Yeah, there's nary a person in this music video who is not pasty white and probably has really strong opinions about kneeling.
Oh my god.
There's no way if you have any good faith opinion on culture and race that this wouldn't infuriate you. It's just top to bottom disgusting. Not to mention it's just a really fucking bad song.
Yeah, it was dumb. I mean, I'm not a country guy, like I've said. I feel like more and more when I passingly hear country in places, I'm not like, but I'm like literally never like, let me click it. It's just like, it doesn't phase me background noise as much. This was not good. This phased me. I was phased.
I've often joked about Hotel California being my least favorite song of all time. And there is an aspect of that song. I just really hate all 5 minutes of that riff and how that song is performed. And I've paid cover bands who were like paying, like people could tip them to play a song. I've paid a band to stop playing Hotel California. Like it's kind of my thing to hate that song a lot. But you know, I mean, deep down, I don't despise the Eagles for making Hotel California. I fucking hate everything about this song and pretty much everybody involved with it because it is representative of a lot of the worst things about us, essentially. Yeah, I wish it didn't exist. I wish this could be scrubbed from existence.
It's an insult.
It's gross.
It's almost like okay. So that whole Apu debate.
Mm-hmm.
It's that.
Sure.
It's like, I know you wanted to say it, and I know you think it's fun to say honky-tonk, badonkadonk. Oh, it's just fun. It's just words. That's culture. You gotta stop. That's all. I don't know. I can't even believe a song. Yeah. I can't believe I thought for 15 years this song was a joke.
And I mean, it's just the video, the song, it takes everything from hip-hop and it scrubs it and just leaves a marketable shell. And then fills it up with manure.
Yeah.
It just fills up with pandery, stinky shit for all of the people who just would get mad about it otherwise.
And that's not to say
it's a rap video. Like, just white people doing it.
And that's not to say that white people can't make hip-hop. That is not the dumb statement we're making. We're saying, though, that
no.
Who you are and the art you make is something else. And the art you make belongs to a community. And you are now telling that community they're invited to be part of this thing because you've decided that part of that culture is yours to share. You better know what the fuck you're doing.
We've praised the Beastie Boys on this show. I don't think any of us love his music, but, like, I don't think any of us would say that, like, 99% of what Macklemore was doing was, like, appropriating black culture for gain.
No, I don't ever think we've accused him of appropriating black culture. We've accused him of appropriating gay culture, though.
Oh, yes, that is true. I did briefly forget about that. But we're not saying that white people can't do rap or hip-hop. Like, that's not the case. We praise the Beastie Boys. What we are saying is this is removing essentially all blackness and replacing it with pandery. It's the natural fulfillment of when we said country music is hip hop for racists. Like many moons ago on that Q&A episode, like this is that got struck by lightning and became a sentient concept. Like that is what this song and video is.
You know, that you just said some really brilliant things that led me to a thing I've never known how to say before. And I think I can sum up why Eminem was so a thing for our generation and why he was so different and why we've never mm-hmm. called him problematic for this one thing. Because rapping about being white is central to Eminem's identity. Eminem has never tried to sound black. Eminem has never right. appropriated black culture. Eminem's rapping is explicitly about his whiteness and about being from a white trailer park and about his white trash ex-wife and about the struggles of being this bleached blonde milk-colored nightmare. But that's his shtick. You know, he's never once... That's what we said about the Beastie Boys. The Beastie Boys never tried to be like, hey, this is how you rap. The Beastie Boys always respectfully sat on their sort of like digital rap sidelines. And the problem here is this does not have that respect. This Eminem has stood behind Dr. Dre for a very mm-hmm. long time. There's yeah. It really is about respect for culture. And part
exactly.
of, I think, why we're over-explaining it is because, you know, you're white and I'm Latino and white, but neither one of us is a member of the black community, and we don't want to speak for a community. We're trying to speak for decency and the community of correctness, not political correctness, correctness. And the correct thing is not to take someone else's anything, claim it as yours, and give it out. And mm-hmm. that is what right. we are saying this song did.
Yeah, there's no acknowledgement of where this song was the bones that he dug up to make this song. Like, there's no acknowledgement of any of that. It's the joke about Arnold Palmer walking into a bar and the bartender being like, hey, try this. It's lemonade and iced tea. And Arnold Palmer going, this is great. I invented this. Like, it's that joke. Like, it's Trace Atkins thinks that this is him. Because for the song to be successful, it can't acknowledge that stuff for its audience. And that makes me, again, want to puke acid from my stomach all over his face and turn his face into a skeleton, a screaming skeleton.
Well, then I think all we can do now is talk about Cascadas every time we touch.
Yeah. Sorry they have to follow that, Cascada. This song doesn't offend me to my core. Every time we touch, I get this feeling. And every time we kiss, I swear I can fly. Can't you feel my heart beat fast? I want this to last. Need you by my side.
The song is just so boring to me. The song is that... I made a comment about early Lady Gaga just sounding like generic gay Euro trash. I honestly, and I'm going to put this out there, I don't know that there's a huge difference between this and Poker Face.
Okay.
I don't think there is. I think the fame is very average. I think the fame, and has Just Dance. And then I think the fame monster is fucking glorious. And I would cut most of the songs from the fame. So it's one of those situations where this is just sort of generic gay Europop. This is just the sort of shit that I feel like, you know, Boyzone made. It's just very gay, dance, shake your head and dance, dance. And it's just like so generic. And I love that Cascada managed to have a strong career. She actually managed to have like 7 or 8 hits. Don't know how she did it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she. You might know Evacuate the Dance Floor.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That sounds exactly like this.
Yeah, Evacuate the Dance Floor. I'm infected by the sound. Stop the Beat is Killing Me. Like, it's actually a really clever song. But again, the music is just very...
Yeah.
It's just very all the same dance song that you've heard a million times. By the way, I was popping and locking that whole time. So I think this song is such a sad note to go out on because this was such an up and down now, and I really do feel like the ending really dragged it down. This is like... This is one of those movies where you think that they're about to find out. It'd be like if Ruby... I'm going to back things up. The first time I saw Rudy, I was only kind of paying attention, right? And I was probably on something, but I was like 26 before I knew Rudy wasn't about like a mentally disabled kid getting to play football.
Did you mix it up with Radio?
Is that the one where they go off the cliff?
That's the Cuba Gooding one where he's like a handicapped guy who is like a sports equipment manager or something like that for a football team. I guess I don't really remember either.
Maybe that's what I thought Rudy was this whole time.
Mystery solved.
Oh my God, I think I combined those two movies. Oh, okay.
Something like that. I don't really remember exactly what role football plays in that movie, if any, but I feel like it does.
Oh my God, okay. I don't even remember where I was going with this. Oh no, I don't remember. Cut the Rudy stuff.
No, absolutely not. It's too good. I'll just say, this Cascada song, I think, would have... Now, there is a version of this that's just piano and, like, ballady. I don't know if she re-recorded or just, like, they just took the vocals and put it over a piano version. I think it's a little bit better.
They just candlelit it up.
Yeah. This song, the Eurotrash version... You know, back when I had knees and any kind of stamina, this would have been like a cool song to play on Expert DDR.
Wow, you just made yourself sound really enticing in bed.
Oh yeah, absolutely. give me 45 seconds and a place to nap. I'll show you a mediocre time.
Right? Like sometimes I think about the way I'm portraying myself on these shows where I'm trying to be not too confident, not too cocky or anything, and I try and act, you know, chill, and sometimes like, man, I'm just so terrible. I listen back and I'm like, God, I wouldn't support me. I sound so unconfident. Well,
I don't want to speak for anyone in the gay community, but I don't think any straight woman should ever fuck a dude who has a podcast, period, so
Yeah.
I gotta keep this one under wraps.
That's fair, except I think gay dudes should all have sex with dudes that have 3 podcasts.
Exactly, 3.
3 podcasts, ladies and gentlemen. Do you know what that makes me? Prime real estate with way too much audio equipment. I got headphones for days. Headphones and comfy blankets, because I know what gay guys like. Gay guys like comfy blankets. Come on over, guys. Big pillows, too.
Well, on that note, Nico, where can people find you?
Evidently in my bedroom waiting. You can find my music project at facebook.com/actionduo. You can find my super awesome comic book starring Kid Riot, the world's coolest speedster, over at kidriotcomics.com. You can also check me out on Instagram at NicoAction. That's NicoAction. I think you can also find me there on Twitter. However, I am positive anything I ever posted to Tumblr was deleted.
R.I.P. Tumblr. You could find me at Chris Podcasts on Twitter. Also, if you like what you heard, you know, we finally really got back to our roots, a deep dig into a Now volume, and we had a good time doing it. So if you like this or anything that we do, an iTunes review would be awesome. Spread the word right into the mailbag if you want to explain the movie Rudy or Radio to Nico, nowandagaincast@gmail.com, and check out everything else.
I forgot the other shows. I keep forgetting I have other shows.
I was just going to say, check out everything else on the Cage Club Podcast Network, including...
X's for Podcast, which is an examination of the X-Men comic book franchise, starting with Giant Size X-Men number 1. But at this point, we just talk about anything. Man, we just talk about so many 70s comics. My eyes are bleeding. And MCU.html, an examination of the inclusivity, diversity, and construction of the Marvel Cinematic Universe that I do with my husband over on our show, HTML, which stands for Husbands Talking, more or less.
And that's it.
That's now it. Get out.
Has turned 21. I don't think we're gonna celebrate the year that I can get that I can rent cars. I think this is pretty much it for landmark nows until 69. So in like 10 years, we'll get to that one.
Yeah.
And until then, with back on the now train next month with now 22, Nico and I will catch you on the flip side.
Coming out. It's there.